It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up in a few moments, a look at media coverage of Ebola and how to draw the line between responsible reporting and creating a sense of panic.
First, we finish our new series looking at issues in the race for Wisconsin governor. Whoever wins the race, they'll have to deal with Wisconsin's state budget in the face of uncertain numbers in the coming year. Sean Johnson has this report.
When Governor Walker kicked off his re-election campaign, he started running a TV ad where the narrator told viewers that it had gotten pretty bad 4 years ago, with a budget deficit of $3 billion.
But it's different now. Wisconsin has turned around. The deficit is gone.
That was in April. As the months went by, tax revenues lagged expectations, falling $280 million short of projections last fiscal year. That might not matter if the state kept larger balances, but Walker's budget had very little breathing room at the end of 2 years. Todd Berry with the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance says, based on what we know right now, it looks like the budget is headed toward a shortfall.
For those of us who have been watching this for a long time, there is a little bit of sense of deja vu. 2014-15 looks a lot like 2007-8 in that we're flirting with minus signs.
Barry says the problem is that the state is spending more than it brings in.
I don't like the term structural deficit because it's being abused terribly by the media and by legislators, but there is a structural imbalance in the current year. You can't continue to spend more than you bring in.
Neither Walker nor Burke has said definitively what they do about the budget next year, though Burke offered a few ideas this week at an editorial board meeting of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
The private school tuition tax deduction is one that I would roll back. I would certainly roll back the voucher expansion funding. So going line item by line item and seeing where are you going to put priorities. Certainly I'd accept the federal Medicaid money.
Accepting federal money to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act would generate up to $315 million for the state in the next two-year budget, according to the nonpartisan Legislative Fiscal Bureau. The other moves would have a smaller effect. Governor Walker spends most of his time on the campaign trail talking about his tax cuts and his first budget.
We took a $3.6 billion budget deficit that we inherited from my predecessor and turned it this spring into a surplus, and we did it the old-fashioned way.
But Walker rarely talks about the projected shortfall, going so far as to suggest that the problem does not exist. Walker is relying on an assumption that tax revenues will grow faster than the Fiscal Bureau predicted. He's also assuming that spending in the next budget will remain almost flat. Budget expert John Peacock with the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families says it's misleading to suggest those assumptions negate any deficit.
He can't have it both ways and keep saying he inherited a $3 billion deficit and say, now looking forward, we don't have a similar sort of problem.
Peacock says the state can avoid tough decisions for the time being because it ended last fiscal year with more than $500 million in the bank.
It's not that you have red ink right now. Nobody's saying that. But it's like being told by your doctor that you have high blood pressure. You're not necessarily sick right away, but you've got to make some tough choices in order to maintain your long-term health.
Walker and Burke both have ideas for how to spend money. Both want to cut some taxes. Burke wants more for education. There's a certain amount of denial going on, Peacock says. Some campaign season wishful thinking. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
When it comes to Ebola, how much media coverage is too much? And when does responsible reporting cross the line into hype and panic?
Fox News anchor Shepard Smith got a lot of attention this week when he raised those questions. Here's a part of the clip that's been all over the internet.
Do not listen to the hysterical voices on the radio and the television or read the fear-provoking words online. The people who say and write hysterical things are being very irresponsible.
And we want to hear from you on this. What do you think of the coverage you've seen, heard, and read? Do you have examples you'd like to share of good coverage and bad coverage? And do you think there's too much, or is this what's on your mind and this is what you want to talk about? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Michael Flaherty joins us now in the studio. He's a senior lecturer in life sciences communication at UW-Madison and a former Washington correspondent. Mike, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, we heard that clip from Shepard Smith. He's not the only one who's raised the concern about promoting panic and irresponsible coverage. Do you think he's right that there's been some overhyped, panic-inducing coverage of Ebola?
Well, absolutely. It's mildly ironic, and perhaps even a form of journalistic apology from Shepard Smith. Fox has been especially, shall we say, dramatic in its coverage, with some of its commentators even calling for a complete shutdown of the United States and President Obama being held personally responsible. So I think it was a breath of fresh air for him to come and say, of all people, let's back up here and talk about what we actually know.
Well, it's a tough balancing act. It's a story we want to hear as consumers. It has an inherently scary side to it. I mean, I think any rational observer worries at least a little bit about Ebola. How does a journalist walk the line on those two extremes, though?
Most of the mainstream reporting on this has been actually pretty responsible. The problem is there's so much of it. There's probably, I think Bloomberg estimated 600 stories a day on this now, so it becomes overwhelming. Mm-hmm. And what the media does doesn't really tell people exactly what to think, but they kind of set the agenda of what people think about. So we have this just onslaught of coverage, and I think the latest poll shows that 70% of the people now are worried that they could get it, which is preposterous.
And I wanted to talk to you about the sheer frequency of coverage. Is there something about, even if it's perfectly responsible reporting, if it's happening again and again and again, does it create an outsized idea of a risk, whether it's Ebola or terrorism or something else?
Absolutely. The average reader probably pays 5 seconds to a news story. So they'll see the headline and they'll see the lead. They don't get down to paragraph 15 that says it's only two people in the entire United States and the odds of catching it are infinitesimal. And a lot has to happen for it even to spread anyway.
USA Today political editor Paul Singer joins us every Wednesday to talk politics. This week, he mentioned the difficult decision-making process in their morning meetings there on how to cover Ebola. Here's a clip.
Are we telling people about an important and scary health situation, or are we fanning the flames of panic? I honestly have very mixed feelings about both our coverage and everybody else's coverage.
So when editors and reporters are having maybe their morning pitch meeting, what kind of things do you think they should be weighing in how and how much to cover Ebola?
Well, there's no doubt that there's a herd mentality. So one medium starts covering it, then it becomes a tsunami of coverage. So every newsroom is probably talking about this. Wisconsin's health department just put out some directives to our hospitals. That made the newspaper. These things crescendo. It is part of the community conversation. What makes it difficult for journalists is we all get caught up in the difference between journalism and all that other stuff in the 24-hour news cycle. And a lot of that doesn't pretend to be journalism, yet even my own journalism students occasionally get it mixed up.
And you teach, among other things, science journalism, I know, and I wanted to ask you about when you've got a subject that may involve some complicated science, like the disease transmission, how do you bridge the gap between what's going on in the scientific and medical communities and the everyday media consumer?
In science reporting, the job is to translate and bring the facts alive in a human story. The problem in most newsrooms is if they're hyping the story, which they tend to do with the headline and the lead and the first quote and the warning and how deadly it is, they're pretty responsible in getting that warning paragraph into the story, but it's so far down that it frequently gets missed. In my classes, which is science reporting per se, that would be a C minus.
Now, I know over the last, I don't know, 5 years, decades, we keep, or decade or so, we keep hearing, major paper X cuts back on science reporters or no longer has a dedicated science reporter. Is the science reporter an endangered species? And if so, what do we lose when we're covering a story, especially one like Ebola?
Well, I think specialty reporting in general is threatened. The Wisconsin State Journal no longer has a science reporter. It does have a very good health reporter, and I think he could be counted on to do an extremely responsible job on this. But throughout the industry, that's what we're missing. Fewer political reporters, fewer city hall reporters, fewer cops reporters, and unchecked, you get kind of a mess on your hand in the journalistic conversation.
We're talking to Michael Flaherty of UW-Madison, looking at the media's coverage of Ebola.
And you can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you seeing too much coverage, or does this topic deserve heavy media coverage? What would you like to see in reporting on Ebola? Are you following the story all the time, or do you want a little Ebola break every now and then? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation and take your calls after a look at some of the latest news with Kristen Durst. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We continue our conversation about media coverage of Ebola. Michael Flaherty's with us. He's a senior lecturer in life sciences communication at UW-Madison.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the media coverage you're seeing when it comes to Ebola? Responsible, useful stuff, or hype and panic? Do you think there's too much coverage? And are you providing coverage on your social media feeds? Are you tweeting and retweeting, passing along stories on Facebook, emailing links to people about Ebola? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go now to Bill on the line in Fond du Lac. Bill, hi.
Hi. Matter of fact, since I called, I started driving in a bad cell zone. But yes, I agree with your guest, and I'm sorry I forgot your name now.
It's Mike.
Oh, Mike, I agree with you. There is too much coverage on it. It's too much hyped up and too much causing panic. Now, the reason I called is that I really like the news source, The Guardian, London newspaper, and I don't read French, but I would be willing to bet that their news outlets are throughout Europe. And they have a few Ebola cases, granted, one here, one there, Sweden and England and France and wherever else. And you're going to have some cases, but I think we can control it. I don't think there's any need to panic about it.
All right, Bill, thanks. Raised a lot of issues there. First of all, he thinks there is too much coverage, but I wonder if you're working at a media organization, are you thinking, this is what my viewers, listeners, readers want? I'm going to give it to them.
Part of it's the nature of American media. This Bloomberg chart shows African coverage. It shows European coverage. And there's a few stories. And then it just spikes with 600 stories a day in America. So we just have this plethora of reporters and journalists and bloggers coming from every different direction, along with the 24-hour news cycle. We used to say there are more reporters covering the New York Yankees for American media than are in all of Africa. So that's the journalistic conversation we have. It's just driven by so many different people, and you really can't control it.
And so Bill's point that we in America are different, we in the U.S. are different, we are covering this more than a lot of other countries?
Absolutely. I think he's right. If you read The Guardian, it would be a very responsible, very toned-down story because it would reflect what's actually happening versus this crescendo of emotion and coverage and speculation. And CNN even had a science fiction author who wrote a book on a pandemic. Mm-hmm. Well, how does that help the conversation? But they had to fill time.
Bill, thanks a lot for the call. We'll
Thank
go
you,
now
Bill.
To Christy in River Ridge. Christy, hi.
Hi.
What do you think about this, Christy?
Well, I just think there's a lot of huge coverage because, I mean, like we've mentioned, it's all over the place. And, I mean, I teach high school biology, and I have students coming in saying, oh, you know, Ebola's in Wisconsin. Oh, my gosh, we're all going to die. But in reality, it's, you know, if you look at the R-naught, it's people, and they don't understand that because that's not covered in the news.
Well, you're right, Christy. It's a very real problem. What Media Matters has found, is it, which is a blog and a watchdog, is the more people see of this and the more exposed they are to the media coverage, the more likely they are to believe it's a threat. So here we are as a country with 70% of us now thinking this is some sort of threat to us, which is preposterous. It's an interesting study in public relations and propaganda, I suppose, if it were actually organized and coordinated. But it's just this frenzy.
Well, but if we're worried that we in Wisconsin might get Ebola tomorrow, okay, maybe that's not realistic. But if we're worried that, hey, if we don't contain this thing now, this is a threat down the road, is that unreasonable to be talking about?
Well, I think that's the subtext in a lot of the stories, that this is a very deadly virus. And if it got out, it would be a huge problem. But it doesn't spread very quickly. It is contained, and I think a lot of the stories are about the need to contain it. Mm-hmm. And that's been pretty responsible.
Christy, thanks a lot. We'll go to John with us now in Milwaukee. John, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, John?
Well, part of me thinks it depends upon your perspective and where you are. So I live in Wisconsin, but I travel down south. And just traveled to San Antonio and then to Dallas. And I just got off the airplane from Dallas. And I actually was looking around. I was like, okay, are people going to have masks on? I mean, like, how far is this thing really gone? So too much coverage, I think part of it depends upon where you're at. If you're in Dallas, you're listening. Or if you're traveling in and out, you're listening. So
everybody's listening. There's no question about that. The question is the coverage corresponding to the actual risk involved? We're talking two people in the entire nation that got it both from the same guy. That's not to poo-poo that this is a huge problem, but the sheer overwhelming coverage of it has exaggerated the risk by almost any measure.
Before we get back, thanks a lot for that call, John. Before, Mike, we get back to callers, I wanted to talk about how social media changes the media equation here. First of all, on the journalist side, we're expecting reporters and producers to be social media content providers here. Does it fuel the flames of overexposing the story when you also have to be tweeting the latest, Facebooking the latest, and not be falling behind the other outlets?
I don't think it's pressure on the reporter so much is the amount that gets retweeted and resent and repackaged, some of it verbatim, which I guess helps journalists become more influential, but it's the way the stuff gets altered and taken out of context, sometimes by people with an agenda. You see that in politics quite a bit, and that doesn't help. But there's nothing you can do to control it. It's a wild and woolly democracy in the world of media.
And a lot of times our personal media filters aren't the news organizations themselves. It's our friends, our online contacts, the people we follow on Twitter.
We have 100 million new publishers in America today.
We'll get back to our callers now. We've got Joanne on the line in Madison. Joanne, hi.
Hi. I guess my concern is that something that you said, Rob, is that you said this is it's very complicated very complicated scientific story about transmission. And it isn't a complicated scientific story. And I think when you say something like that, you make it seem you put the public off. And in fact, it's very difficult to transmit. But it needs to be clear that it's very difficult to transmit. It has to be people actually working with. In nearly every case, it's someone working with an infected patient, and it's person to person contact. It's not airborne, and that's the kind of information that is not being spread. I think the flu is going to be far more dangerous for people this year than Ebola will be.
Joanne, thanks for the clarification. So a simple message, she says, but she says she's not seeing it in the media.
Well, I think she's absolutely right. This is a very difficult disease to spread. And the cases of it spreading, it's very clear what happened. In the mainstream media, that has been reported, but it gets downplayed because it's further down in the story, and there's just this sheer onslaught of why this is a bad disease and why we have to contain it first. And then the fact that it's a low risk is usually later in the story, if at all.
Joanne, thanks. Jeff on the line now in Milwaukee. Jeff, hi.
Yeah, hi. I'd just like to make a comment that Yeah, there's no comparisons given in the media. So, for example, when a plane falls out of the sky, we're all told, hey, there are less deaths from planes falling out of the sky than driving your car. I think the number of fatalities annually in the United States is about 35,000, 60% of which are caused by drunk drivers. I mean, there's more chance that I'm going to get killed driving my car to work every day back and forth than I'm going to contract Ebola.
Jeff, I want to jump in just a few moments, Mike, to respond how the media quantifies, explains relative risk.
Well, relative risk, they do a nice job. The caller's exactly right with plane crashes, but we lose about 7,000 to 8,000 people a year to cancer from smoking in this state, which is an enormous social and health problem, which rarely gets reported.
All right. Well, thank you for all your calls. And Mike, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
That was Michael Flaherty. He's senior lecturer in life sciences communication at UW-Madison, talking to us about how the media is covering Ebola.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. More to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll hear about a place where you can experience True Dark, a festival dedicated to stargazing with no distracting human-made lights, the Jasper Dark Sky Festival, which kicks off today.
First, the Government Accountability Board is an independent, nonpartisan government agency, so it's likely to upset both parties. In a sense, that's its job, according to a group of Wisconsin political scientists in a Milwaukee Journal Sentinel opinion piece.
Last week, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss called for the ousting of the head of that board, along with an overhaul. But four University of Wisconsin political scientists responded to that call by defending the GAB.
Barry Burden joins us now. He's a professor of political science at UW-Madison and co-author of that piece. Barry, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi there.
Well, you say, along with your co-authors in this piece, that far from overhauling the Government Accountability Board, we should consider it a Wisconsin idea that we should be proud of. Now, it has come under fire recently from Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, from Democrats in the past. So why do you say this is something we should actually be proud of?
Well, you know, people who live in Wisconsin may not realize it, but elections are run very differently in Wisconsin than in just about every other state. In most states, the central authority in charge of elections is a partisan elected official, often a secretary of state, sometimes an elections board of some kind that is effectively run by the party that controls government. And so you have tangled up in those states what you would hope would be nonpartisan, competent administration of elections with party politics, because the person's name is on the ballot, they're associated with a party, and they're also in charge of running elections. In contrast, Wisconsin has established this independent professional board that is supposed to be, and we think is, insulated from party politics.
Now, to go back to the board's creation back in 2007, how did it come into being?
Well, it's really the successor to something known as the State Elections Board, which had been in place for decades, and was also something of an independent entity, although both parties had some control over the membership. But there were some concerns in the mid-2000s about some campaign fundraising scandals that were going on in the Capitol and other things. And so there was an effort in the legislature to redesign the agency to make it more independent and give it a little more authority when it comes to investigating ethics and campaign finance. And that proposal sailed through the legislature. Almost every member of the legislature voted for the GAB the way it exists now, and Governor Doyle signed it into law. So it's been now, 6 or 7 years in existence.
Now, we make the case, and you've been saying that this is a board that is independent. Can you tell us a little bit about how it functions, how its members are chosen?
So the board itself is made of 6 members, and they have a rotating membership. There are members coming in and out, one per year, essentially. They are former judges who have been chosen by another pool of judges to be potential nominees. and then selected by the governor and approved by a supermajority of the state senate. So it's a very complicated multi-stage process, but the idea is that we're selecting people who have good judgment, who have been on the bench, who are separate from party politics, and who have bipartisan support because they're going to need to be supported by the governor and by two-thirds of the state senate. And so that's who makes up the membership. And today, most of those members have been appointed by Governor Walker since he's been in office for the last 3.5 years or so.
Now, in the piece, you write that many of the legislators who voted for the Government Accountability Board creation are now beating up on their own creation because it's become inconvenient. What do you mean by inconvenient?
Well, you know, the staff at the Government Accountability Board make recommendations about how to implement various policies, how to make administrative decisions. Those recommendations have to be approved by the board itself, by those retired judges. Some of those are going to be things that irritate people who are in partisan politics. They're not going to like the way a ballot is designed. They're not going to like the way an investigation is happening. They're not going to like the way signatures are being reviewed on petitions, which candidates make the ballot, which don't, all of those things that an agency has to decide on a daily basis. But we think that's a good thing, that party politicians ought to be unhappy with the agency from time to time. That's a sign of its independence, not a sign that the party in control ought to go in and change it for their convenience.
Now, right now, it's the Republican Party, notably Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, who's upset with the Government Accountability Board. But it hasn't always been the Republican Party. It's been Democrats in the past as well. Can you run us through a brief history of the complaints against the GAB over the years?
Sure. I mean, the Republican complaints have been more notable, and they've been in the news a bit more recently, but Democrats have had their share of gripes as well. Most recently, there were some complaints that the GAB was moving ahead with implementation of voter ID when it wasn't necessarily required to by the court. There were complaints from Democrats back in 2012, when the recall elections were being scheduled, that they had allowed these so-called fake Democrats to run in the Democratic primary. There were complaints years before that that allegations of ethics violations by some Republican state senators were being dismissed by the GAB. So there have been complaints from both the left and the right over the years.
Now, do you think that any of these complaints, maybe starting with the most recent, have been legitimate and should be looked at, or do you consider these as things that are politically motivated and maybe come with the territory?
It's going to be a little bit of both. I mean, There are always degrees of reasonableness when making decisions. I personally would put more trust in an independent professional staff that has expertise in these matters than elected partisan politicians. But, you know, the legislature has the right to change the law. If they're unhappy with, say, the way the John Doe investigations have proceeded or the way ballots are designed, they can get in there and do the hard work of writing legislation, which I think is preferable to tinkering with the agency itself.
How likely do you think it is that this time around any of these criticisms will result in changes to the Government Accountability Board?
Well, Assembly Speaker Voss has essentially promised to do just that. And there's a lot of discontent among Republican legislators with decisions coming out of the GAB. So I suspect there will be some bills floating in the legislature next year. And it'll depend on who's the governor and what else is on the table, whether the budget or other things end up dominating legislative time, but I think there'll be some effort to, if not do away with, at least modify how the GAB operates.
Why did you and your colleagues feel motivated to speak out about this so strongly at this point in time?
You know, when I'm at a conference in another state or I'm talking to election officials or lawyers or other people who are in this field, Wisconsin is held out as a real model of nonpartisan election administration. It's something we think the state ought to be proud of. That's unique and really ought to be a model for what other states should do. And so to see it come under attack and maybe revert to a system that's more partisan or less independent, I think would be a real shame.
Now, even independent organizations, nonpartisan, they're not foolproof. There can be problems that are legitimate and need to be addressed. Do you see that as something which may be true in the case of the GAB?
You know, again, there may be individual issues that need some legislation to deal with them more directly. I think the campaign finance laws are moving fast enough and the court decisions are coming rapidly enough that there may be some interest in modifying those, and that's a task the legislature should take on. But honestly, I think there are bigger fish to fry when it comes to improving elections in Wisconsin. If the legislature really wanted to improve the system, I personally would focus on something like redistricting reform rather than tinkering with the GAB.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Good talking with you.
We've been speaking with Barry Burton, professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He wrote an opinion piece along with three other UW political scientists defending the Government Accountability Board after Assembly Speaker Robin Voss called for its overhaul. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Some people may feel a sense of sadness that the nights are getting longer, it gets dark earlier. Others see this as an opportunity to spend more time looking at the stars.
One of the best places to stargaze is in Jasper National Park in Western Alberta, Canada, an official dark sky preserve. Every year they hold the Jasper Dark Sky Festival, which starts tonight. Here to give us a preview of what's happening this year is Brian Attree. He's the Director of Business Development for Tourism Jasper. Brian, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
So it sounds like in 2011, the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada officially made Jasper National Park a dark sky preserve. What does that mean exactly?
They've given us the responsibility to protect and promote the nocturnal environment and the clarity of our dark skies. We are trying to support and encourage public understanding of how important this natural wonder is and how people need to look up at the stars and say, wow, this is amazing. It's clear. There's not man-made light or any haze from pollution. So it's quite a nice designation. And we are actually the second largest in the world, but we like to claim we're the largest in the world because you can actually get to us.
Now, we hear about a lot of different types of environmental protection, but how does this work? What kind of specific things do you do there to protect the night sky?
Well, because we are in a federal national park, development is extremely limited. And so at that given point, by being in a national park, there isn't any factories, there isn't any pulp mills, we don't have refineries, commercial buildings are limited, and even housing is limited. So whenever you want to develop in a national park, you have to go through permitting. And again, if you have to build, you have to cut down a tree. And if you're in a national park, you don't cut down a tree.
Now, unfortunately, Rob and I are not going to be able to make the journey to Alberta this year to take part in the festival. So if we were there, what would it feel like to stand there at night and look up at the sky?
Oh, I date myself sometimes and say it's just like when you were a kid, so I'm not going to do that. But if you think back to the 80s, and again, I think I just dated myself, when you could go outside and look up when you were in town and just see the Milky Way. And for people that can understand, what was it like to look at the Milky Way when you were in town? And now if you go to any town or city, you don't get to see the Milky Way. And for here, I can drive 4 minutes from my house, step out of the car and look up. And if it's a clear night, I see the entire Milky Way.
I'm a little bit jealous, I got to say. Now, this is the fourth year of this Jasper Dark Sky Festival. What kind of new ways do you have to appreciate the darkness this year?
Well, what we've done this year, we've extended the festival to 10 days, and in the past it used to be one weekend. And so what we've done is we've anchored it on two different weekends, and by bringing some businesses on board to promote the dark skies and promote being outside in October, because it can get a little chilly, and, you know, we're up here with the metric system, but I'll translate that. This morning when I was going to work, it was 25, and that's not 25 Celsius, yeah, 25 Fahrenheit. And moving into the day today, we're looking at about 40, but it's clear skies, blue skies. And this weekend, we've had Brewster, one of the big tour operators in Alberta, put on the Dark Sky Glaciers and Stargazing Tour. And what they've done is that they are taking people out at night now to the Athabasca Glacier, and you're going to do a glacier adventure out onto it with the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada, and there will be telescopes set up, and people are able to be on the glacier looking up at the clear skies, and then they'll come back and they'll go for dinner, and then they'll go to the brand new Brewster Glacier Skywalk and have another session of astronomers there with you. And then moving to tomorrow night, the Fairmont Jasper Park Lodge, they have brought on the Edmonton Symphony Orchestra into town, and they'll be having the symphony outside under the stars.
Wow.
So
wow.
Dress warm, but nothing like listening to classical music in crisp, clear skies. You don't even need a light.
Well, you must need some kind of lighting, right, for safety to see where you're going and footing. How do you light just the path for people's feet?
red lighting is what keeps your eyes adjusted to the dark. So we use LED tube lighting. You can even use just little LED lights in a mason jar with some red cellophane over top of it, a flashlight, put some red over top of that as well. You can get around, but anything with white light, absolutely bad for your eyes, and then you lose your night vision.
Now, I've been foiled a couple times hoping to see stars by Lake Superior and then realizing I'm up there with a full moon. And the moon's lovely, but it means you can't see those stars. You're blinded by the moon. Do you schedule this to include some moonless nights?
We've scheduled around a little bit from that, and one part of the aspect of the moon and eclipses and whatnot, we're actually very lucky to have the festival fall this year. On the 23rd, we're going to have a partial solar eclipse in the middle of the afternoon. Coming up for this dark sky festival, we will be lucky that we won't have a full moon blinding you out, but that's another aspect, actually, of being in a dark sky preserve. I've been outside with a full moon. It's beautiful, and you can see all the stars still.
Next Friday you have an event. It's called Beyond the Stars. What's that?
Beyond the Stars is a no-charge fee. It's adding on to the festival. It's been one of our signature programs, and we will have activities set up out at Lake Annette, and that's deeper into the forest, so to speak, around Lake Annette. And in the field at Lake Annette, we'll have that low-level red lighting and the LED plastic tube lighting. And we will have First Nations and Aboriginal content telling stories of their heritage amongst the stars. We'll have Parks Canada interpreters running heritage programs. We'll have Parks Canada and guest photographers night photography lessons. We'll also have TELUS World of Science Edmonton running some science demonstrations. And some of our guest speakers will be doing some armchair pop culture topics in the stars. One of them will be doing Hollywood Across the Stars. So you're moving around from station to station at a very large field, and then you'll have the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada from Edmonton. There will be about 30 of them with their deep star telescopes set up, and you can drop in and look up.
And you'll have one of the most famous scientific Canadians there, I understand, who has covered David Bowie in orbit, Colonel Chris Hatfield. What's he going to be doing at the event?
Absolutely. So on October 25th, we have our evening of space and music, and Colonel Chris Hatfield will be giving his keynote presentation. But we've also brought Jay Ingram, who is the former host of the Daily Planet on the Discovery Channel, opening the show. And Jay's brought along his scientific band with him, so he'll be moving his way through pop culture and stories of science. And then Chris Hatfield will string a tune with Jay and his band a few times. And Chris will be telling about his time up in space in command of the International Space Station, and if we have been good enough and we've impressed him enough, maybe he will even string the space oddity for us at the end.
Nice. Well, you described a bit for us what it's like to look up and see the entire Milky Way. I'm curious about how people react. I'm sure this draws huge numbers of people, and children among them. What do people say?
Wow. that is pretty much people. There are some people that get very emotional. They remember what it used to be like, and then they start to see the impact of man and the impact of oil and the impact of pollution, the impact of everything on the earth. And, you know, at the end of the day, people are driving here to get here, and we are going to do what we need to do. But by having these national parks in place, it just reminds people the importance of having national parks and these dark sky preserves so you can still come and see it, that it's not going to disappear.
And do you hear people who have been to this saying, we need to do something at home to make it a little darker and make our sky maybe not, you know, as star rich as it's going to be there, but, you know, appreciate the night sky a little more?
I think the first step, what people like to do, is look at what kind of light bulbs they're using in their house and that impact from there. I think at the end of the day, everybody realized the way the society is going and culture, we're never going to be able to get rid of it, but it's your impact, your footprint on it that you can just lessen a little bit.
Do you think it is that important? It's more than just coming out to Jasper to see the night sky, that people should actively be working toward preserving darkness around the world.
I think so, absolutely, and this is the first step that people will realize it, because I'm not from Jasper. I've moved to Jasper in the last year, and I come from British Columbia, and I came from a place where I thought environment was huge, and it is, and lived in a city and then moved out to Jasper, and I even looked at it and went, wow, okay, there is impact going on, and what can we do to diminish it? And by just being able to come to a dark sky preserve or a national park and enjoy the night sky, it makes you reflect a little bit.
It is a dark sky preserve. Is it the dark sky preserve? Are there others?
Yes, there is. So I would encourage your viewers or yourself to go online and just Google dark sky preserves around the world, and there is a large number of them. Another one is Wood Buffalo in Alberta. That's the largest in the world, but kind of hard to get to. But with us, we're the second largest in the world, but they are giving the status to other national parks or provincial parks or state parks around the world. There is a big movement in the United States for dark sky preserves as well.
We could have, you know, people going out there now to enjoy all the things going on at this festival, but if someone just comes during an off time of year when there isn't the festival, is it just as majestic?
Yes, and where it does come into play, we say that we try to highlight it in October because the nights are longer, it gets darker a lot faster, and we're able to promote it and we're able to focus on it. But if you came here in the middle of July, you're just going to have to wait till about 1 o'clock in the morning for it to get dark.
And Brian, I've got to ask, what's your favorite part of the Dark Sky Preserve and the Dark Sky Festival?
I really like the Beyond the Stars at Lake Annette. It's a real festival-like atmosphere. It shows great partnership between Parks Canada, First Nations and Aboriginal groups, our group at Tourism Jasper, businesses in town, TELUS World of Science Edmonton. It's a wide scope of people getting together to put on programming and really enjoy yourself.
Brian, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Brian Attree. He's Director of Business Development for Tourism Jasper. He was with us to talk about the Jasper Dark Sky Festival, which starts tonight. I would love, maybe this is a bucket list thing for me. I don't know. You?
Well, it's hard not to want to look at a dark sky on a glacier.
Yeah, right? What's wrong with that?
It sounds incredible. I have to admit it.
I always think, like, you know, thinking about how ancient Greek sailors would have looked up at the sky, or the Incas or Mayans would have looked up and seen all these stars. I want to get that view sometime. Sounds like a great time.
I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Farad. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.